Good evening. I'm Kilowatt 2, Romeo, India, Whiskey. My name is Dick. You will also hear Kilowatt 2, Kilo, Echo, Yankee. His name is Mel. Mel and Dick claim to be the coordinators of the technical net. Coordinators, interlocutors, leaders, who knows what. We try to organize this, this group of enthusiastic people who meet most Sunday evenings, and the clan gets, information gets passed. That's the main purpose of it. Main purpose of the technical net is education. And no guarantees. And the price is right, if you know what I mean. We do our best to give you accurate information. Occasionally we make errors, and we, when those are pointed out to us, they get corrected at a later time. Everybody has a certain batting average. You have to accept that. Another thing that you will discover is that Mel and Dick make an attempt to take material that previously has been described in ways that are difficult to understand, and through our experience and the experience of the people who help us, we try to make it more understandable. There's a lot of brain power that gathers to the technical net. Thank goodness this particular machine covers southwestern Connecticut and southern New York and northeastern New Jersey. As I said, there's a lot of brain power in that area. From time to time, people will hear a subject being discussed. They say, aha, I know something about that. And they chime in and they give us the advantage of their wisdom. Another thing you should know about is that no question is wrong with reference to ham radio subjects. There are people who feel intimidated because at first the material is not so easy to understand. Brand new material is always like that. You're always going to feel uncomfortable learning something you've never known before. And the first time it's explained to you, you hear vocabulary you've never heard before. There's no such thing as a dumb question. The philosophy of Mel and Dick is that the dumbest question, and I use that in quotes, is the question where there's the greatest amount of difference between what the person knows and what he would like to know. If you think about it logically, the dumbest question is the one that most requires an answer. And you've often heard people who develop a slightly elitist attitude in which they say, I'm not going to answer that question. It's beneath our station. Well, that's not the right way to treat it. Treat a person who wants that kind of information, in my opinion. So don't feel intimidated because you think you've got a question that you think is a dumb question. Don't let that stop you. By way of the discussions that take place here, people learn a little bit more about antennas and transmission lines. Those are really tough subjects. The books do a really yucky job of explaining that. We think we do a slightly better job. I didn't say it's super easy, but there's ways of making it easier. So-called complex mathematics, where you've got an I in the formula, you've got a real and an imaginary. That's just a mathematical way of saying that there's a 90-degree phase shift between something you're measuring and something you consider the reference. That's where this imaginary stuff comes from. On an oscilloscope, it's not too difficult to demonstrate what a phase shift is. Many people get very intimidated by the word phase shift. Well, don't be scared by it. Just keep listening, and eventually it'll make a little bit more sense as time goes on. That's what we believe has taken place. Mel and I get some very nice emails from people who say, let me drop this. I probably came pretty close to timing the machine out. That's another thing you got to worry about here. After every minute or so, watch you watch and make sure you do a drop so that the machine does give you a beep. And we all get excited. Try your darndest to wait for the beep and maybe a second or two beyond before you pick up. If you pick up immediately and the machine doesn't get a chance to retime itself, you'll be timing out the Eastern machine, which people try to use on the eastern end of Long Island to hear what's going on. Or you may be timing out the internet connection where people out of area get a chance to sign in or listen to the TechNet. I think I've given you a little bit of the philosophy of what goes on. A person signs into the TechNet by giving Mel and Dick your call letters, your name, and please try to remember to give you your name because I'm awfully forgetful on names. It's not many people who sign in from time to time. And the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. A typical sign-in would sound like this, KC2QIQ. Glenn, and yes. Glenn is a frequent person giving us information, for instance. Okay, give me your call letters and name, and that word yes at this time, K2RIW, listening.
And 2EO, Rich and Yes, good evening.
KC2, QIQ and Yes.
Get November. Wesley, Yes.
AC2AZ, Yes.
AC2SYL, Bill, No.
Yeah, this is K2KEY with a request, Bert, Dick, over.
Okay, so far I've heard Rich, Glenn, Wesley, Mel, and Joe. Go ahead with your request, Mel, and I hope I'm going to be able to hear you. K2LIW.
This is K2KEY. First of all, do you copy me, Dick, over?
Roger, Dodger, loud and clear.
KB2VBN, yes.
Okay, everybody, hold on one. Dick, last week at 11:30, I did a little tutelage, if you remember, on a Smith chart, an application that I came up with. Well, I got a lot of emails, and some of them were for some people said we put it on too late. We didn't tell them that there was going to be a Smith chart tutelage, and so on and so forth. And I got a myriad of comments that said everything from I don't think it'll work, and others that were very interested that they are in the teaching end of electronics and would like to hear this again. So around 9 o'clock, is it possible that we could take out a few minutes a little earlier and I could go through this one more time if you think it was viable, over.
Excellent suggestion, Mel. Okay, so at 9 o'clock, we'll go over to the Smith chart. I did a little bit of study of that this week, and I've had some opinions on that. And it sounds like you requested an email on the subject. Last week's email, I thought that was a record with 168 emails. Wow. All those people with all those questions. Not easy to keep up with it all. Okay. I think we've got, let's see now, there was one person, KB2VBN or VDN. Your signal is extremely weak. We're going to have trouble. But you're about the fourth person on the list. First person on the list was Rich, N2EO. What's going on in Whitestone tonight, Rich, N2EO, K2LIW in the TechNet.
W-H-Y-Y.
Yeah, Joe, you're on the list, and you said next week, but I think we're going to consider you this week. Rich first. Go ahead, Rich.
Okay, Dick. Trying to go by on the beat, and 2EO. I wonder if anybody has any information on the Mars program. Not the planet, but military affiliate radio system, Mars, in particular Air Force Mars. What's going on in Mars today? I've been in the Mars program back in the late 60s. At that time, I'm sure everything has changed. That's before satellite communications and internet communications. There was a lot of military traffic being handled from Southeast Asia back to the States. I wonder what's going on in the Mars program today, in particular Air Force Mars. I understand Navy Mars does not exist anymore. So there's Air Force Mars and Army Mars. And what you have to do to join the program. And I'd like to listen in first if somebody could give me some frequencies, in particular if anyone knows the frequency for the New York State Training Net, the New York State Traffic Net. Back to that, N2EO.
Yes, the Eastern Link is down.
Okay, we've heard that the Eastern Link is down. I know that we're having some trouble with it this week. Let me take a quick listen. Yeah, I'm not hearing anything out there. I know they're having some trouble with its controller and its computer, and whether or not it's gotten repaired is an interesting question. To anyone who listens to the Eastern Link, in the last 12 minutes since the net began at 8 o'clock, was the Eastern machine on at all, or was it off continuously for that time? Anybody who's got that information, please tell me right now.
Yes, the link has been down since you came on at 8 o'clock. It's A2GJE, over. He's out.
WA2RYY. Okay, K2GJE says that the link has been down. down since 8 o'clock. And Joe, W-A-2-R-Y-Y, maybe you have some further information on that. Go ahead, Joe.
Yeah, the comment I'm going to make is you keep on timing out this reflector that we're connected to, and that's probably why the link is down going to the Eastern machine. You keep on timing it out. You have to leave more time between transmissions. You can't jump on top of it when you hear the courtesy tone, because I'm getting no time delay. In fact, you knocked my nod off the reflector, too. If you are transmitting more than, like, 3 or 4 minutes continuously, it will bump everybody off the reflector. Dick.
Okay, Joe. So you're saying we better make a drop on the machine once every minute or so, maybe 2 minutes maximum. And then when somebody passes the ball from one person to the next, wait for the beep and wait 1 or 2 seconds beyond the beep to be sure all of the links and whatever set up are reset. I know that the guys controlling the machines are in the process of correcting this and making it more compatible. But for the time being, they've got a cantankerous controller on the Eastern Link, the 147.375 machine, a cantankerous computer and or controller, which has been giving them trouble over the last week or so. And that's one of the first things that we time out, as well as the IRLP link or the Echo link. Alrighty. Let me drop. On the subject of military-affiliated radio system, or military amateur, I think it's military-affiliated radio system, MARS. Back in the old days, it was a voluntary service that amateur radio operators joined and got qualified for, and in the process of handling traffic which was needed for the armed services, for servicemen that were on foreign lands, or even in the United States but far away from home, ham radio operators would handle traffic usually between the service person and their family, and in return they acquired points, and therefore they were able to visit a MARS center where surplus equipment was being stored, and they were able to select pieces of equipment that their points would allow them to obtain. And whether or not that equipment that you obtained, you know, capacitors and transformers and transmitting type equipment and whatever, whether or not that was allowed to be held permanently or on loan to the MARS participant, I'm not quite sure. The main question that Rich is asking us is, which of the MARS frequencies and services are currently in existence, and what frequency should he list? Are there websites giving MARS information? Anyone with MARS information, please give me your call letters right now. K2LIW, my name is Dick.
AC2AZ.
Okay, first person we heard was AC2AZ. Go ahead, Paul.
No, Dick, it's Bob. Listen, I just did a quick search on Google for MARS, and it seems like they have a very active website with all sorts of links, news and events, and links to join. I think if you do a Google search, I think you'll probably find a ton of links for all the information you need.
Yeah, I guess it's AC2AZ, and I made the mistake of thinking it was KC2AZ, so I called you Paul. Very fine, Bob. So you use nothing but the word M-A-R-S as a Google search word, or did you use some of the combination of words? Back to you, Bob.
No, I just spelled it all out. Military affiliate radio, and put that in there. First thing that comes up is Wikipedia, the next one down is Mars, I think. Let's see, I'll tell you exactly what's going on first. First one is Wikipedia, the NETCOM Army Mill website, so that's definitely the MARS website, and it looks very active, and there's plenty of stuff up there, so there should be plenty of information to track down frequencies and activity and application forms and everything else.
Good information, and thank you, Bob. By the way, you picked up before the machine gave a beep. We're all getting enthusiastic and jumping on top of that timing. Anyone else with any further information on what MARS frequencies and what MARS services, military, I think it's affiliate radio system, what frequencies and what services and what training and things like that exist right now, other than what Bob just told us by a Google search. Anyone with any further MARS information, Please give me a call. It is right now. Please wait for the beep.
KC2CUS.
Sounded like KC2TUF, Tango Uniform Foxtrot, is what it sounds like. Please correct me and give me your name, sir, and then your information.
As you know, you needed to be corrected. Tango and Dick, this is Bill, Charlie 2, Tango Uniform X-Ray. Actually, I was talking to him a while ago regarding Mars. I'm actually going up to New Hampshire tomorrow morning to get some training on Mars systems, Army Mars, because we're getting the system at work. And those frequencies are held very close to the vest. I've been searching for months and months and months and have not come up with any frequencies. The only time I came up with one was I happened to be looking at a picture of somebody at a Mars station, and I just looked at the radio and pulled the frequency off of that. So they're really tough to get a hold of. I think they keep them quiet for, you know, I guess security reasons. Over to you, Dick. KC2CUS.
Very interesting. So is it your best guess, Bill, that a person who wants to volunteer for Mars service first join an organization? Hopefully the websites will tell you where to go and who do you talk to and how do you fill out the application. And I guess I'm going to, maybe the method of operation is to allow people who are qualified to know what the frequencies are. Is that approximately what you think is taking place, Bill? Go ahead.
Yeah, that's all I can tell right now. Like I said, we're getting the system in at work for emergency communication, and I haven't received a Mars call sign yet. But when I do, I'm sure I'll probably be getting a boatload of information, and you know, I'm sure it's going to be. Obviously, I'll know by the end of the week. I'll tell you more about, you know, what, why it's limited. And I apologize. I don't know enough information right now. But like I said, they keep those frequencies tight to the vest. They don't want anybody to know for some reason.
I guess we can make some good guesses as to why. Okay. We're smarter now than we were before, and I thank you, Bill. I'm going to pass it back to Rich, the guy who asked the original question, N2EO. Drag your feet a little bit in case there's anyone else that wants to add to our Mars question. N2EO, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KB2VDN.
KB2VDN. Very weak signal, but I think we're going to pull you through. Start off with your name, sir, and the information that you've got on Mars.
This is Freddy, KB2VDN, Brock. See, I'm part of a Navy Mars. There's a lot of training in that. You got to be dedicated. Right now, I'm trying to get a new radio so I can keep up the transmission. Get back to the control station.
Yeah, I think I heard you earlier tonight, Freddy, mention the fact that particular radio you used to use on Mars stopped working properly, and many other radios you can buy are not easy for them to be reprogrammed to the frequencies outside of the ham band. Most of the Mars frequencies, to my knowledge, are outside of the ham band, and so some radios can be reprogrammed, or you can cut jumper wires in certain places so that other frequencies are allowed to transmit with the synthesizer built into the radio. So that's one of the many difficulties. And Freddie was mentioning the fact earlier that it's rather difficult to buy equipment that has known capability on the Mars frequencies. And so I suspect there is a need for a website that will say ICOM model so-and-so and Kenwood model such-and-such has this capability when you make these modifications. That's the kind of information which I think you'd like to have, Freddie, and I bet you Rich would like to have it also. N2EO, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, K2RIW, TechNet, Weimark, N2EO. Yeah, I think he's talking about Navy Mars, and my understanding is Navy Mars is no longer in existence. I don't know why they canceled the program, but I understand there is no more Navy Mars. There is Army Mars and Air Force Mars, but I believe that's it, to the best of my knowledge. Yeah, well, I'm going to check out these websites. No, I thought maybe the training frequency would be published. I see things have changed because in the 60s and early 70s, it was no big secret. I mean, everybody, they published these frequencies in QST even. And one of the big Mars proponents was the late Senator Barry Goldwater. K7UGA was AFA7UGA in Scottsdale, Arizona. And he ran a lot of Mars traffic and had people working at his station in Scottsdale. I believe it was in Scottsdale. So I see things have changed drastically, and I think I know the reason why, the Homeland Security thing. Back to net, N2EO.
That's good, Rich. As you find more information, let us know. And be wary of the fact that quite possibly the frequencies, they want to keep them close to their chest. And maybe a person who joined Mars is probably given instruction not to publish those frequencies. And if that's true, we have to honor that request. The next person who signed in was Glenn, KC2QIQ. The last I know, Glenn was going to do some listening to the moon bounce experiment that's taking place at Arecibo, Puerto Rico, using the 1,000-foot diameter dish, which has a brand new name that I can no longer remember, but for a zillion years it was called the Arecibo Ionosphere, and it was called the Cornell University Ionospheric Observatory. That was its official name for a lot of years. They changed the name. It's like Nassau County Medical Center. They keep changing the name, and I can't remember anything but Nassau County Medical Center. Well, that's what the name of the place is to me. So, how is Ebo? Let me drop. I was going to use a 400-watt transmitter starting on, I think it was, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, a 400-watt transmitter into that 1,000-foot diameter dish, which has got 60 decibels of gain. And they're going to be transmitting on 432.045 megacycles and listening 15 or so KC above that, 5 to 15 KC above. And the prediction was that a single Yagi handheld on 432 with 100 watts of power, because of their real good hearing system down there, they're going to be able to hear you. Each one of these days' worth of moon bounce took place for approximately 2 hours, because the moon moves 14.5 degrees per hour, and you have to carefully choose the day of the month and the time of the day when the moon sweeps directly across that dish straight up. The dish is aimed straight up. They can steer plus or minus 15 degrees or so by moving the feed horn on that spherical surface. It's not a parabolic surface. It's a spherical surface. They got a very fancy feed horn that's suspended 500 feet above the center of that 1,000-foot diameter circle. What a system. A few of my friends have, let me drop. A few of my friends have had the opportunity to ride that cable car that brings you to the focal point of that dish. And I think what the dish is used for, the original experiments it was designed for, which was doing radar mapping of Mars and Venus and Mercury, and maybe even the sun, that dish has got some fantastic capability when each one of those objects sweeps in front of the dish. So the original intent of that was to listen to echoes off the moon, to hear radar transmitters, among other things, that are on the opposite side of the Earth, back in the days when we worried about foreign transmitters and what was their capability. And that had limited success with that operation. Now, they started on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, as I said, at around noontime on Friday and 1 o'clock in the afternoon on Saturday, and Tuesday and Sunday at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, 2:40 I think it was. And the first day's operation on Friday, they had a failure of their 400-watt amplifier, and depending on which website you went to and which expert you listen to, they either were down to 20, 30, or 50 watts of power output. They were using the exciter directly without the power amplifier. However, when you got 60 decibels of gain, that's more than enough. A good buddy of mine, AF1T, Alpha Foxtrot 1 Tango, his name is Dale Clement, a real good VHF operator on 10 gigs from way back. He knows how to build good low noise front end. And he filed a report on the microwave reflector of WA1MBA, Whiskey Alpha 1 Mike Bravo Alpha, has for the last 10 or 15 years run a listserv of microwave enthusiasts. Let me drop. And Dale and his wife, Mickey, filed a report that he heard some nice strong signals on his Yagi. He then went down to a three-element Yagi, still heard them. He went down to a dipole with a good sensitive receiver when he was located in a very quiet area of Vermont where he lives. And very weakly, he was able to hear the signal off the moon with a dipole. But that's really pushing it. So it looks to me like anybody who had close to one decibel noise figure without a whole lot of local noise, let me pick a number. They recommended to use a 15 decibel gain Yagi antenna aimed at the moon during that operation. And if you had 100 watts of power, it was essentially guaranteed that except for pilots, they would hear you and you would easily hear them because of the great amount of gain they've got on that end. And you got to worry about the 2.5 second delay and whatever. Now, Glenn, as I remember, I think, Glenn, you were about to make an attempt, and maybe you know of some other people in Long Island who attempted to at least do some listening, if not transmitting. So maybe this is not your question, but if you're willing to give us any information along these lines, it would be helpful, Glenn. KC2, QIQ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yes, good evening, Dick. Good evening, everybody on the net. Yes, Dick, that's why I signed in, just to give you a little update on what happened. The receiver I was using was the ST-736R, and the Yagi that I was using was a 19-element Cushcraft, and I was able to use a program from the Internet, a little website that was called Moon Tracker, and basically I just plugged in my coordinates, and it told me where basically to point my antenna. So basically it's about 60 degrees of elevation, and between 90 and 100 degrees, which is more like east, more east than south. And basically tuning around, I was originally started tuning at 432, 045, let me let it drop for a second. Then I tried tuning around that area because I didn't hear much of anything in that area. But as I started tuning down to 432, 0402, that's where I started hearing something. It was very, very light, and I started moving the antenna around a little bit. And I started getting, basically, by, you know, playing with the receiver a little bit and checking the modes between lower sideband and CW, I started picking up the signal in that area. Just barely moving the meter, S1, S2, maybe, with the arc beam opened all the way up. And what it basically sounded like was not really a CW signal. It sounded more like a digital mode signal. So let me pass it back to you, Dick, because that was my question. I didn't hear CW, and it was closer to 040 than it was to 045, and I was wondering if you might have known any a little bit more about the signal. Was it really a digital signal favoring the lower sideband to CW, closer to 040? K2RIW, KC2, QIQ.
Sounds to me like you were successful, Glenn. The game plan was they were going to use on Friday, start off on single sideband to get rid of all of the people who wanted to sign in for this particular experiment. And sideband is a lot faster than Morse code. They were going to run sideband first and then Morse code second to pick up the weaker guys. Then on Saturday, they intended to use a similar scenario, sideband and then CW. To my knowledge, on Friday, because of the low power amplifier, because the high-power amplifier had failed, they probably used CW almost exclusively, although I heard tell that there were some sideband QSOs. The game plan for Sunday was to start using some of the WSJT weak signal Joe Taylor K1JT modes of operation, which are a digital mode where a series of four individual tones are transmitted at different periods of time in a like kind of a computer program, I can't remember the exact name of the program, would demodulate that. And therefore, you can send much weaker signals with that weak signal Joe Taylor type mode of operation. So it sounds to me like you were hearing the digital data that they were using today. And whether or not they use digital for the whole 2 and a fraction hours, or digital for some of the time, and then Morse code for some of the time, and sideband for some of the time, an enthusiastic person should stay there and listen for the whole period of time. Let me drop. And one of the reports I did hear is that the frequency was lower than expected. They were expected to be on 432, 045. Various people have thought they were on 432.040 or 042, numbers like that. They were low. Now, were they low because of a negative Doppler shift? In other words, if the moon is on your western horizon or beyond your meridian transit, it's a fancy way of, if you drew a line directly above your property, starting at north, going straight overhead, and then going south, and you fill up that line with a plane that goes to your property, that's your meridian plane. When the moon crosses your meridian plane, it's as close to straight overhead as it's going to get, so to speak. And if it was rising to the east, you might get a somewhat positive Doppler shift because you're on the surface of the Earth that's rotating and you're moving toward the moon. When the moon moves toward your west, you're going to get some negative Doppler shift because you're now moving away from it because of Earth's rotation. That's one of the variables involved. There's another one.
Dick, WHCDL for information.
Yeah, how are you doing on that eastern input, Andy?
Yeah, it looks like we have a bad modem, the DSL modem at the Selden site, which has not been replaced. To just let you know, so the link is dropping, going on and off on its own. It's not the IRLP dropping out or timing out. The problem won't be corrected until the DSL modem is replaced, and that's what everything is pointing to. Just to let you know, so just keep on talking, keep the net up, but this will be occurring until this is fixed, and that's what's going on.
Yeah, earlier in the week I heard the Eastern Link dropping out at mysterious times long before it should have been timing out, so I knew that something more complicated was taking place. I think now we have to be a little bit careful on the timing to make sure we don't time out this machine, and also the Echo Link, which maybe is or is not connected to this machine. So. Andy, can you tell us what is the timing on this machine where we will time it out if we just talk continuously like I sometimes do? Number two, how long should we wait after the beep? And will that affect whether or not the IRLP, the people out of area who want to listen to and sign into the TechNet, what timing must we use to make sure that they have continuous capability? The B2CDL, K2RIW.
You know, you're asking too many questions at once. If Eric was on, he would clear up some of this. He's not on yet. He'll probably be on later. As far as I know, this repeater has about a 2.25 minutes. It was like 2 1/4 minutes approximately timeout. So, and it should say repeater timeout. You'll hear that. So that's standard. Just, you know, the unkey just waits for the beep on this repeater. My phone's ringing. Somebody's probably calling me to tell me what's going on. Stand by a second.
Okay. Hello?
While we're waiting for Andy to come back, I'll, go on with what I was saying, and that is, so they are lower in frequency, Glenn, and it sounds to me like you were listening to the digital modes, and I am guessing that they might not have used the digital modes continuously all of today. Wonder how long you had a chance to listen to them, and did you hear anything except those tones at approximately 432.042 megahertz? Over to you, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Sorry, WHCDL, let me just finish up.
Okay, and do also tell us how long we should wait in order to not time out the Echo Link or IRLP. Over to you, Andy.
I believe the IRLP itself is about 2 minutes or so before it times out. And it should say that as well. I know that Eric was experimenting with it. The bottom line is, I know we have a problem with the, looks like it's the DSO motor, so I'm just letting you know about that. So, just wait for the normal beeps, you know, unkey, wait for the beep, and continue. But the input will be going down because it has been, until that's resolved. That's all I want to make. I got to get back to what I was doing, so I'll talk to you.
Very fine, Andy. Glenn, back to you. To your knowledge, Glenn, are you one of the very few people on Long Island who is doing some serious listening? I know of others were talking about the possibility. I know that a few of the guys, Skyler, a brand new ham, for instance, was discovering, much to his disappointment, that the possibility of listening to the Arecibo moonbound signal by way of an FM receiver is probably almost impossible unless you have an extremely significant antenna, like a whole bunch of Yagis, well-tuned and well-aimed, as they were doing at the Eastern VHF conference that took place this weekend in Enfield, Massachusetts. And I'll be telling you a little bit more about that later on. Back to you, Glenn. Were you the only guy? KC2QIQ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, very good, Dick. No, I'm sure I wasn't the only guy, but I wasn't aware of anyone. I kind of found out about this a little bit on the late side. I just by chance heard everyone talking about it this afternoon, or actually close to this morning. And, you know, at that point, that's when I asked you what frequencies they might be trying this on, and I'd see if I can give it a try. A couple of other things to mention about this signal. I think once you were pointed relatively close to it, I don't think you had to be exactly on it, because you could hear it even slightly off. It wasn't like you had to be perfectly on it to hear the signal. It was pretty strong. Strong meaning that there wasn't any real interference around or anything, you know, nearby. So it did give you the availability to, like, kind of like tune in on the signal and then move the antennas around a little bit to get the strongest signal. The antenna that had the highest gain certainly won, and that was, you know, horizontally polarized. And, you know, that was my 19-element Cushcraft antenna tuned for 432. So that all worked out pretty well. But I think the signal was strong enough that even I could have responded to it, but I just wasn't sure what kind of software, what kind of digital mode they were operating in. I was wondering if maybe you could share a couple more words on, you know, the Joe Taylor software and possibly where you can get a copy of it, where maybe I could get a copy of it, because I do use, you know, the satellite transmission transceivers, and if they do something like this again, it would be something nice to try, you know, load that in on the computer and see if I could emulate that mode. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
I'm not completely familiar with the various digital modes that Joe Taylor has come up with. There's at least four or five protocols, depending on whether you're doing long-distance tropo, whether you're doing meteor scatter, or whether you're doing moonbound. Each one of those digital modes has a slightly different protocol that favors that kind of signal characteristics, time delay, and whatever. So I'm reasonably sure that if you Google the words Joe Taylor or K1 Juliet Tango, he lives in Princeton, New Jersey. He's a Nobel laureate. He won his Nobel Prize for the work he did at Arecibo on pulsars. He did some very good work approximately 20 years ago. And one of the conferences I attended a year or two ago in Enfield, Connecticut, or was it Philadelphia, Pennsylvania? I think it was the Philadelphia microwave update. Let me drop. Had a nice opportunity to talk to Joe, and he's a fairly enthusiastic 2-meter moon bouncer as well as a 432 enthusiast in his private life. And he showed us all the actual great big gold medallion that he won as a Nobel Prize. And he gave a very nice talk. He was the guest lecturer at the banquet lecturer, I guess I'm going to call it, banquet speaker, at the microwave update of a couple of years ago in the Philadelphia area. and he showed us some beautiful pictures of the transmitter and the other hardware at Arecibo, Puerto Rico, that he was using. He was doing mostly receiving work when he was listening to pulsars. You don't transmit to pulsars. But I'm pretty sure if you Google various words of WSJT, Whiskey Sierra Juliet Tango, that stands for Weak Signal Joe Taylor, K1JT Joe Taylor, you Google those various words, you'll eventually find information on these various modes. I know there are websites on it. I know that the software is freeware, downloadable. Lots and lots of hams are using it. Quite possibly there's somebody within the sound of my voice right now that'll tell us a little bit more about how you find further information about the WSJT protocol so that Glenn can find out more about it. If you've got some further information, please give us your call letters right now. KQRIW in the TechNet. That's a little bit disappointing. Among the very serious microwave operators, well, I better say VHF, UHF operators, because where WSJT is being used. I haven't seen it used a whole lot on 10 and 24 gigs, but that just may be a matter of devising the right protocol that works correctly under those environments, and a matter of also of getting those people to start using it. Just to give you a little bit of a rundown of what we're talking about here, there's something in the vicinity of 600,000 ham radio operators in the United States. When it comes to how many hams per population, there's roughly one ham radio operator per 500 people in the general population. The very serious microwave operators, the guys that are on 2,000 megs and above, maybe even 1,000 megs, there's one of them per 500 hams. So we're talking about four human beings per million in the general population. That makes them pretty rare. There's something in the vicinity of 1,000 of these guys. Maybe it's a slightly smaller number than that. And maybe it's closer to 300. 100 of them will get together once every 2 years at a microwave update. The very next microwave update is going to take place in the Dallas-Fort Worth area this particular year. So if you you really want to talk to the guys that get the technical and get pretty deep. They're doing moonbound, meteor scatter, and forward-propagated tropospheric scatter, or whatever. It's a really exotic mode. And these guys, let me drop, really have to build their equipment because there's very little they can buy. So, looks like I haven't been anywhere near as helpful as you would like tonight, Glenn. Sorry about that. But if I had a chance to review my microwave update, my microwave reflector, the WA1MBA website. If you just simply go to WA1MBA.org, you'll find a lot of information on these subjects. Yeah, I think it's .org. Whiskey Alpha 1, Mike Bravo Alpha.org, WW in front of that. And you'll get a very nice introduction, and it branches out to a whole lot of other websites. Among other things you'll find there is my my article about how to get a perfect impedance match to any dipole, whether it's part of a Yagi or not. Back to you, Glenn. Sorry I couldn't have been more helpful. Looks like we don't have any WSJT experts on frequency right now. Although maybe later on tonight one of them will show up. KC2QIQ, K2RIW. By the way, how did you aim that Yagi of yours? Was it on a tripod or did your hand hold it? Back to you, Glenn.
To answer the first question, Vic, it was actually on a nest tower that's mounted off the back of the house. So basically, I did it for, you know, right inside from the station, just by positioning the antenna, manually positioning it, you know, with rotator control, because I don't have these two rotators that run with the software that I have now for satellite control. So basically, I was setting up for satellites, and I kind of just moved over to the 432 band and tuned everything up over there. Oddly enough, it worked very well, and Vic, believe it or not, it's very, very useful information that you've given me. One, I'm just glad to hear that that digital signal most likely was what they were using, and that it really was a receiving contact. It's really sparked my interest quite a bit from the information that you gave me about the Joe Taylor software, because now in these digital protocols, because there are a lot of these signals out there. I'm sure that that wasn't the only one, where other people are using it for other purposes. And I'd like to know a little bit more about it and you know, see what, how much of these signals are really out there. Because there are a lot of digital modes being used today, and I think that's one of them, especially in these areas for VHF and UHF, where you have very, very weak signals. It can be very, very useful. But thanks again, Dick, and you're going to leave heads back to you, K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
N2EL.
Kilo 2, Bravo Delta. Okay, a weak signal, Bravo Delta, but again, signed in after Rich. We're going to go in that order, Rich, and then Bravo Delta. Go ahead, Rich, into EO, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, I think you come back in 4 hours. We have an HD in the dining room upstairs right now. I think it's when Google's WSJT software, he probably will come up with what he wants, because I had downloaded the software a couple of years ago. I didn't play with it seriously. I just wanted to see what it was. But I think if you Google WSJT or WSJT software, it'll probably come up with it.
KC2SYL, still with a comment. SYL recognized, and you're after Bravo Delta. Bravo Delta, I think that's John, KD2 Bravo Delta, in Seagirt, New Jersey. Speak nice and slow, and let's hope you make it, John. Give us your information. You got it, John.
Good evening, this is K2RIW on the TechNet from Kilo Delta 2, Bravo Delta. I just wanted to let you know that I copied some CW today, this afternoon, for SIBO, and possibly some sideband a little bit earlier today. The CW seemed to start around 3:21 central.
Antenna, by the way, is an antenna that was invented by K2
WE6YND. WE6YND, I used to know him very well. I was in an antenna competition with him, a man from California, who's now an attorney, but a good ham radio operator, and he invented a, let me drop. He invented an extremely easy to reproduce antenna. It consists of approximately a 1-inch square wooden boom. The 8-element version, I'm going to guess, is around 6 foot or 8 foot long. And the elements, the driven element and the reflector, are made out of 14-gauge household wire bent into a square loop. That's why it's called a square loop Yagi, which is called Quagi. And that's the driven element assembly, and the rest of the elements on the wooden boom are, again, pieces of copper wire. So the antenna itself probably has $5 worth of materials in it if you bought everything brand new. And so it's a very crafty antenna for people who like building antennas. And if you're a VHF, UHF operator, you certainly want to consider building your own antennas, at least as some of the experiments you do with this band. You get a lot for the bang for the money. So, wonder if you tried doing a transmission to them, John. Kilo Delta 2, Bravo Delta, K2LIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW on the TechNet from KB2BD. No, negative. I didn't try to transmit. I have a transmitter problem in the rig. This is a Yaesu FT726R. Yaesu FT726R, and I have no output on it on 432, unfortunately. K2RIW on the TechNet from KB2BD.
Very fine, John. You came through beautiful that time. FT726R, barefoot, no preamplifier, and you didn't transmit because it has no transmitter output. I guess a partially failed rig. I think that rig is capable of putting out 10 watts. 10 watts into that Quaggy. There's about an 80% chance I think they would have heard you as long as you weren't buried in the pileup. And you do have a little bit of a problem when you're doing this moon bounce operation. You got guys scattered all over the planet that are able to see the moon at that time. They're all transmitting toward the moon, transmitting, trying to get a QSO card from Arecibo. So a guy in Japan may have been transmitting at the same time you were. Not a chance in the world can you hear the guy in Japan or the guy in Japan hear you. But both are being heard as an echo of the moon down to Arecibo with that great big dish. So you're not hearing the guy that's giving you interference, and therefore it's very difficult to skillfully choose a frequency out from under the crowd. But we do recommend that you spread out because after they whip certain people, they're going to start scanning other frequencies. Sounds like a good, successful day, John. Thank you for that information. Bill, KC2SYL, is going to give us some more information. Go ahead, Bill. K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, this is KC2SYL. My name is Bill in Whitestone, New York. Just to report, on QRZ.com, there's a link for forums, and if you click on that link for forums, there is some discussion about the experiment today. When I looked earlier this afternoon, there were about four or five entries, and some of those also included projection of the path of the moon over the site and some calculations as to the elevation. Also, I'd like to give you a signal report. I used Yaesu 817. I did hear something, but I couldn't identify what the signals were. Very faint. Just using basically a bank mount antenna in the house. And additionally, I'd like to ask a question, if possible, about any experiments or any reports of radio signals bouncing off the volcanic ash. This is KC2SYL. The name is Bill. Back to the segment.
Yeah, when it comes to bouncing signals off of the volcanic ash, I've got some good guesses on that one, Bill, because I've been down that road, so to speak. And I think we amateurs will hear very little bouncing off that ash. And if you do get bouncing off the ash, it really is not a bounce, but a refraction. The ash probably has a higher dielectric constant than ordinary air. So if there was a cloud of ash essentially midway between you and somebody you want to talk to, and you're on a VHF frequency, where ordinarily Earth curvature would make the signal disappear. Because the ash went up to numbers like 35,000 feet, and it has a high dielectric constant, a signal that's coming from over the horizon, hitting the ash, will be slightly deflected downward, and you'll have a little bit stronger signal in that forward direction. But I think that amount of performance improvement is likely to be slight. And so we'll be hearing in the next few weeks whether or not anyone did an experiment on the HF frequencies. There's also in the job, there's an ongoing experiment where in, I believe it's Nova Scotia, a enthusiastic amateur has set up a 2-meter beacon with the antenna aimed toward Ireland and Western Europe. Let me drop. Smoke clearing. And they were trying to find out how often the signal on 2 meters goes across the big pond. And so whether or not any extraordinary 2-meter reception from that beacon in Nova Scotia is being heard in Europe, Ireland, England, France, we'll be hearing about that. Now, when it comes to precipitation scatter, a precipitation scatter is something that I personally have experienced and used on a number of occasions on the 10 gigahertz band. When you look at individual raindrops, which are essentially spherical objects that will do a excitation and re-radiation, in other words, some of the signal on 10 gigahertz hits that water droplet and sets up a miniature dipole of electromagnetic field in that water droplet, and the signal gets retransmitted from the water droplet. You're about to ask, will that work on the 10 meter band, 30 megacycles? The answer is essentially no, and a second I'll explain why. It's a function of particle size, the diameter in wavelength of the particle that's doing the reflecting, refracting, retransmitting, call it what you like, scattering of the signal, bouncing of the signal. You can give it many, many names, but it's called Mie reflection, M-I-E. A man with that last name, M-I-E, wrote a series of articles that you can read in the radar antenna handbook by, all of a sudden I'm trouble thinking of his name, Skolnick. Mr. Skolnick has written two very pivotal books. One is called Introduction to Radar. One of them is called The Radar Handbook. In both of those, you can look at the chart that's labeled Mie scattering, M-I-E scattering, and you'll discover that the signal falls off 12 decibels per octave in reflective signal strength as you go down in frequency, and it's got the maximum reflective characteristics where the circumference of the water drop is equal to a wavelength. So you get some beautiful reflection at 10 gigahertz. You'll get approximately a 12 decibel weaker reflection at 5 gigahertz, and so on all the way down. So by the time you get down to 1 gigahertz, rain scatter reflection is essentially gone. By the time you get up to 24 gigs, it's starting to get really significant. I am guessing that the particle size of the material that's in that volcanic cloud is so darn small, each individual particle is so darn small, and nowhere near as conductive as a water drop. Therefore, until you get to 10 gigs and above, I'm guessing that using the cloud directly as a reflecting medium is going to be very difficult, as I said, until you get to those kind of frequencies. So that's a little bit of a thumbnail sketch as to what I think is going to happen on that frequency with that medium, Bill. Now, the next person who signed in with a question, we just hit 9 o'clock. Let me pick up Wesley very briefly, and then we're going to go over to Mel's question. N2XJN, T2RIW.